Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. The magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your door 4 times a year. Each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including, from time to time, yours truly. So, this high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And because the KingCast listeners are in the Fango family, they're offering you a 25% off your order code. If you go to Fangoria.com, use the code KingCast when you check out. That's 25% off. Code KingCast at Fangoria.com. Now on with the show.
My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam! Bedlam!
If I were to go see a dead body.
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm your host, Eric Vespi, and today we are taking a little stroll down Mrs. Todd's shortcut, Stephen King's short story about very quick road trips. Well, a little bit more than that. We'll get into that in a second. Our guest today is a screenwriter and has a new flick coming to Netflix called Woman of the Hour, directed by and starring Anna Kendrick. I think it's Anna. Yeah.
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. Anna? Which hits October 18th. We'll talk about that and then dive into Mrs. Todd's shortcut. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Mr. Ian McDonald to the KingCast. Welcome to the show, man.
Thanks. Thank you so much for having me.
We were talking a little bit off air before we started recording, and I was telling you about how I got to check out Woman of the Hour in advance of this chat, and because it's not out yet when you're listening to this, you still got a couple of days, babies. And I was watching it going, you know, like, oh, this is okay, cool. It's a 70s period thing. I'm like, oh, there's a bad serial killer kind of guy going here. And then like all my brain was starting to percolate, and then there's a dating show segment, the dating game, where the killer is on the panel. And I was like, aha, I know this story. They got this. They're pulling from, you know, some really like real serial killer stuff here. Because there was a famous killer that was on the dating game. And I'm like, I'm going to bring this up during the chat and sound super smart. And then you name the killer and it's actually the one I was thinking of. And I didn't realize going into this that this is essentially, you know, like what David Fincher did with Zodiac. You're like, oh, I want to tell this story of this insane serial killer in the 70s. Can you talk a little bit about wanting to do this?
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, you weren't wrong. You were right.
I was right, but I thought I was going to be really smart and like, oh, there was subtext. Here's a new, kind of like how, in Dirty Harry, there's that killer that's like, that's like obviously based on Zodiac, but they didn't call him that. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to know this because I listen to true crime podcasts. I'm going to sound super smart. And I'm like, okay, dummy, that's actually the fucking movie you're watching.
Yeah, it's about Rodney Alcala, and more specifically, we tell it largely through the prism of a lot of the women he encountered throughout his killing spree. You know, we tried to keep the focus on them as much as we did on him. I read about it, you know, I wrote the first outline for the movie something like 8 years ago at this point. You know, this is, you know, how long it takes movies to get made. I remember reading about him, and of course there's something sort of like interesting and sort of like flashy about, like, you know, a serial killer in the dating game. But the more research I did, the thing that I actually found so interesting about it was, like, you know, I feel like sometimes in true crime circles, people will compare Rodney Alcala to like Ted Bundy. And what I really think they mean by that is, like, you know, he's kind of handsome and he's well-educated and, you know, sort of charming. But there was like a real key difference between the two, which is, you know, Ted Bundy was kind of a chameleon. He was really good at making people think that he was something he wasn't, like this sort of Boy Scout, persona. And Rodney Alcala, he sort of flaunted what he was, you know, like all those stories you hear about, like, someone's discovered to be a serial killer and people who knew him are like, no, not Ted. You know, that was not the case with Rodney. Everyone's like, yeah, that kind of checks out. So the more I read about him, the more I realized that the real story was kind of less about him and it was more about everybody else around him that kind of looked the other way and enabled this, you know, awful behavior, because there were red flags, you know, left and right. But they were red flags that people were culturally conditioned to ignore. And so that was the thing that I found really interesting about it.
Now, I'm very curious about the dating game angle, because this is, you know, I'd say it's about half of the movie is, or half of the script is in this segment, you know, where we're kind of following Anna Kendrick's character, you know, but we've, you know, what I really like about the way you've structured this is that you've set it up so we know who she is leading into this. She isn't just the girl that's, you know, asking the questions or whatever. Like there's in a different world, this is like her La La Land, right? Where she's getting a little bit of a break and, you know, we've seen her struggle to pay the bills and maybe my heart's not into this. And we get the time to establish the characters. And you've also paralleled that with setting up, you know, how dangerous Rodney is. So by the time that they're in the same studio together, you're like, you actually give a shit, which is a little bit of a Stephen King-ism, to be honest, is spending that extra little bit of time building character before, you know, just throwing the bad guy in with the, you know, the lead of your story.
Yeah, no. I like to think that the film is somewhat character-centric. As opposed to plot centric. And, you know, there's different reasons for this. There's, you know, there's a pragmatic reason and then there's the creative reason. And the pragmatic reason is really just like, you know, I don't know if you've gone back and watched any of the old Dating Game episodes, but basically every episode had two segments with two bachelorettes and three bachelors. And each one lasted like 12 and a half minutes long. So if you're going to tell a whole movie about that, like, well, there's only so many ways you can do that, like really stretch that time out. Either it's like the opening of your movie and then you just move on from there, or, you know, you have to tell it in a nonlinear fashion. And that was kind of the more interesting to me, because it creates space for all these other sub narratives. So there was that. And there was also just the fact that, like, in terms of like true crime serial killers, I think it's tricky because, you know, there's a way in which psychopaths are not super interesting as people, you know, like they are puddles, like emotional puddles that we assume must be oceans because what they do is so dark. But in a lot of ways, they're pretty simple. They're people where, you know, making other people feel bad makes them feel good. And they're driven by that compulsion. And that's the thing they do, you know? And I think where I've bumped on other true crime films is where maybe they romanticize it, or try to lend it some sort of weird sex appeal. And so, you know, I knew that I didn't want that to be the focus of the movie. I didn't want it to be a movie about like a serial killer. Because frankly, I find all the, you know, again, victim is sort of a reductive word, but, you know, a lot of the female characters far more interesting, and more empathetic and more identifiable, you know, like, you know, I live in Los Angeles. I'm trying to be a screenwriter. I clearly identify more with her than him. And so that's someone that I just want to spend time with. And also going back to the Stephen King of it all, like part of what I love so much about his writing is that, like, if you jump into the horror too quickly, well, it doesn't really mean anything because you don't really care about the people who it's happening to, you know?
Exactly.
It's like,
yeah.
I look at so many of his books and, like, I mean, I just reread The Shining not too long ago. And I was thinking, you know, the copy I have is, you know, something like 600 pages. And I'm just like, if he was a first-time novelist working today, like, I'm just positive the editor would have said, like, you have to cut this book in half.
Yeah.
You know, and it would have been all the weaker because of that. Like, you need that running space.
Yeah. And it's interesting that the movie, you know, is debuting on Netflix, which is kind of famous for having an algorithm dictate what they want out of movies. But, you know, one big compliment I can give Woman of the Hour is that it doesn't feel like it's under that mandate. It's not like, okay, you got your jump scare exactly, you know, a minute and 45 seconds in, and then every 10 minutes there's a creepy scene. That, like, it just feels organic and it's allowed to grow into the story that it's telling. So I really dug it, man. And I hope everybody else likes it too.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
We usually ask the first timers here what their Stephen King origin story is. And it occurs to me that I did not prep you on this in advance of hitting the record button. So apologies for kind of ambushing you with this. But, you know, I'm going to ask, what is your Stephen King origin story? Meaning, you know, kind of when did he first pop up on your radar? Like, or what's the thing that hooked you, you know?
Yeah. No, of course. I mean, I think I started reading him in like seventh grade. I, you know, my first book was Carrie. And as a seventh, eighth grader, whenever it was, you know, it felt like edgy and dark and dangerous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but there was also this, you know, teenage adolescent aspect of it that just felt true and really well observed. And I loved it, but also like I'm from Maine originally. And like growing up, like not only did I not know anyone who, you know, worked in the film industry or was like a working novel. I didn't know anybody who made their living doing anything creative at all, you know? And so to me, he was this just incredibly inspiring person where it's just like, oh, you can be from Maine and have zero connections to the art, entertainment, culture industry, and still find a way to kind of like make a living at it, you know, and he makes an astoundingly good living, but still like just to be able to make any living at it was impressive. And, you know, in a weird way, growing up, I found myself really enamored with a lot of kind of regional authors and filmmakers. So like, you know, George Romero, you know, and David Cronenberg, like it didn't matter that they're from like, you know, Pittsburgh and, you know, Vancouver, I think is where Cronenberg's from. But just the fact that like, oh, they didn't have immediate connections was so inspiring. And he was just sort of my North Star, you know, professionally and creatively. And, you know, as I got older, eventually I moved to Los Angeles and, you know, it's my home now. I love it. But for the first few years, I got like really intense homesickness, and I would sort of deal with it by rereading Salem's Lot and Pet Sematary and On Writing, because it's funny, you know, his books are, you know, they're scary and they're fun and they have great characters, but they're also really wonderfully evocative depictions of place and a people, you know, there's a way in which I think they've sort of, over time, like, oh, Stephen King writing about Maine has become a sort of caricature of itself. Not that he's doing that, but that's the perception of it. But like, you know, I would read these books and he would talk about like, you know, Scarborough or Portland or Freeport or any of these places that like I spent time at growing up, and it would take me home. And his depictions of, you know, kind of small town life, like not the scary parts, not the exciting parts, but, you know, the quote unquote, like boring parts of the book were what I really kind of latched onto. It would take me back home when I was missing home the most. And like all great authors, I mean, my relationship to his work has changed over the years. You know, why I read him when I was 15 is very different than why I read him now. But that sense of place and that sense of place, not just in terms of like the people, but also just like the landscape and the changing of the seasons and things like that. One of the things that continuously sort of pulls me back to his work, you know, when I was younger, I think it was mostly I wanted to read about vampires. And now I'm actually really enamored with like, you know, how he'll describe the sounds in the woods, you know, at night, something like that.
Right. Yeah. Somebody, I never spent, you know, any time in, the Northeast at all, you know, growing up, but I did read a fuck ton of Stephen King. And I can tell you when I finally made the trek and I'd been like, you know, to the East Coast a lot, you know, but mostly kind of just stayed in New York and like maybe once or twice around, you know, around Boston. And that's as far as I got. But, you know, I finally made the pilgrimage up to Bangor in like the late 20 teens. Mm-hmm. And into speaking to, you know, his power in writing, you know, I'm walking around there and I'm like, I feel at home. Like I recognize this place. It's like, it's not just seeing the landmarks, although that helps, you know, going and sitting and, you know, in the park, looking at the Thomas Hill standpipe or whatever, and just going, I'm fucking in it right now. You know, this is, you know, I'm walking around Derry, Maine at the moment, you know, there's the bridge over the river and like everything is as I'd read it. But I've noticed that that he has a talent for that, not only just for Maine, but like his Florida books. I have a sneaking suspicion that, you know, having now gone back and kind of reread and studied, you know, a lot of his Florida novels, if I walked around Sarasota or whatnot, you know, that I would recognize that just like I recognized Bangor, you know, and felt like I'd been there already.
And I mean, also like Colorado and The Shining, like there's a very vivid sense of place, and it's interesting. I feel like he tends to return to this theme a lot of people who live in a place year round and people who are kind of coming and going, you know, like in The Shining, you know, you have, I'm forgetting his name, the manager of the hotel, where it's just like, you know, this is his pride and joy. And what is it?
It's like Olwen. Mr. Olwen, something like that.
And you know, it's,
I have a Stephen King podcast. This is something I should know. So
no, it's, yeah. And I just, there's,
Old Man Olman.
Olman. Yeah.
Stuart Olman. I was close. I was within, I was within enough range where they might give it to me on Jeopardy. So I'm going to take that as a win.
All right. Yeah, I don't know. Like, just the issue of class, there's sort of the haves and the have-nots and the people who are struggling and the people who are wealthy and the people who kind of like, quote unquote, belong. And like, you know, there's this kind of, wherever he writes about, like, you know, he's a really talented noticer of people and situations and behaviors. And yet he does it in a way that is simultaneously like very regionally specific and yet in this broader sense, just deeply American, you know? And so his story, you know, you can read a story set in Maine, even if you're from, you know, Los Angeles, and you're just like, oh yeah, I feel that. I've seen that on some level. And I, you know, it doesn't look exactly the same, but like LA is also a place of the haves and the have nots and, you know, in this very vivid sense. And so, you know, it's, I don't know. He's got a gift.
And he's got a gift that he's so good at. It's like watching the top tier athletes do their thing, because on the surface you go, of course, you know, just listen to people and then write that down. And that's true. But that's like saying, of course, just swing the bat and hit the ball into the stands. Why don't you just do that every time? Or like somebody who's a tennis pro, where you're going, oh man, they only volleyed for like 45 seconds. Then you try it and you go, oh, I can't even get one over the net. It's like, you know, there's some people where, you know.
Well, I'm interrupting.
Well, no, go for it. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I think one of the things that I think is so interesting about him is, so like, I've always thought that, like, you know, if you know, like, I used to teach screenwriting at colleges, and I always used to say, if you really want to appreciate what makes something like Citizen Kane really special, watch it back to back with How Green Was My Valley, you know, which won the Best Picture Oscar the year it came out. And it's a very good movie, but Citizen Kane is 40 years ahead of its time, and How Green Was My Valley is not, you know?
Yeah.
And it's only by comparing two things that are kind of similar that you realize what makes one special. You know, the way you appreciate Seven is watching it back to back with like Kiss the Girls, you know? And, Harlan Ellison said something once where he's just like, look, there's a lot of best-selling authors out there. Most of them aren't actually great writers. Stephen King's a great writer and he doesn't need to be. Like, that's the weird thing, is like, he's in, and like, one of the things that I think gets overlooked so often in his writing, you know, because he's great with character, he's great with story, he's great with atmosphere, his language is just like, it is simultaneously like really, really unpretentious, but also very vivid and artistic and interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, there's this one line from The Shining that like I just love and I'll never forget, and it's where Jack's describing like picking Danny up off the floor and breaking his arm, And it's something like the snap of the breaking bone had not been loud, but it had been very loud, huge, but not loud. And it's just like, that's such a weird, interesting way of putting it. Like, I can't imagine putting those words down on paper. And yet you read that, it, you know, it was huge, but not loud. And you get it immediately.
Yeah.
And it's like, and again, it kind of goes back to that thing. He's a great noticer.
Oh yeah, very much so. I mean, I have a Stephen King podcast, so of course I like the dude, but you know, it's so funny. Everything you're talking about, it's just like, yeah, there's a reason why the Koontz cast isn't a thing. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, I and it's kind of unfair, to be honest, because I remember, you know, King was the way that J.K. Rowling got a lot of kids in the generation after mine into reading. Like, I think King got a lot of my generation into reading. And I remember, you know, because I was reading King in elementary school, and, you know, I remember reading Cujo in sixth grade, and you know, and I read all the Thick Boys, The Stand, and, like, you know, the Talisman, and all these big books before, you know, my voice broke, and it was so unfair because I got so excited about it because I'm like, oh my God, like, this is what books are. And then I would go and find a horror book with an interesting cover at, like, you know, at a garage sale or something, and like, you know, open it up and go, why isn't this the same? You know, why is this confusing to me? Why don't I care about the people? Why do I think the monster's stupid? Like, you know, and it's so unfair to pretty much everybody else. I think it took me a while until I stumbled on Crichton. And then when I was reading a lot of Crichton because of Jurassic Park, I was reading a lot of Crichton. And then I got to the Sphere and Congo and all these just fucking incredible, like, page turner books that he put out around that era. Mm-hmm. But it pretty much wasn't until him that I was just like, oh, maybe all writers suck except for Stephen King.
No, I mean, you know, he sets the bar high, and what's interesting is I feel like, you know, and the same thing could be said about almost any book, but, you know, I feel like they kind of go as deep as you want them to, you know.
Right.
there's and actually I take that back, that's not true for a lot of books. They don't go deep, you know.
Yeah.
And you can look for it, and you can sort of apply, you know, a kind of academic exegesis to it and find meaning in it, but it's not really there. You know, you can draw a line between any two points. But it, you know, I always thought it was interesting. Like, David Foster Wallace apparently taught Carey in his Introduction to American Fiction class. Hmm. And I want to say he said, like, The Stand was one of his favorite books of all time or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, and so there's a lot about his work that's, like, deeply experimental too. Like, you look at Carrie, you look at it, like, they're very experimental books, and because the stories are so compelling, I think that oftentimes gets neglected, that,
right,
that he's taking these, like, really weird narrative risks that are, you know, interesting and, you know, semi-postmodern. And yeah, I don't know. It's just interesting to me about, like, what aspects of his work gets attention and what aspects it's somehow ignored, you know?
Right. Yeah, because, like, I can think of, like, a lot of the metaphysical shit, which kind of ties into the topic we're about to discuss. So this might be a good segue. But, you know, I think about that where, you know, let's exclude the Dark Tower for now, because the Dark Tower was never, maybe up until the release of the final book, it was never, like, mainstream King. That was, like, niche even for Stephen King readers for a long, long time, these books. And they play a lot with metaphysical, and you talk about shit that takes narrative risks. That is the Dark Tower over and over and over again, book by book.
Yep.
But, you know, thinking of it, like, you know, they have that whole, you know, let's go get high and, you know, goes inhale smoke until we get high and have a vision on, you know, on Pennywise coming to Earth and, you know, prehistoric times and all this shit, you know, stuff that's just so random and out there that, it, you know, for something that still feels so grounded, it's crazy that he's able to get away with it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but yeah, let's turn to the topic at hand, which is Mrs. Todd Shortcut. That's a different story. So this is a short story. It was, one of the ones that was published in a magazine first and then rolled into a collection, namely Skeleton Crew, this one. Would you be willing to kind of give a bare bones description for people, catch them up and remind them what the story is about in case it's not super fresh on their mind?
Yeah, sure. So it's, It's basically about this old man named Homer Buckland, who the story opens, he's sitting on a porch with a friend of his. I can't remember the friend's name, but it's sort of a slightly younger man who's sitting there patiently listening to Homer sort of reminisce about the past. And in particular, he's thinking about this woman who he knew when he was much younger named Ophelia Todd. Todd's in that name. You know, it takes place in a small town in Maine where there's like the people who live there year round and then the people who come in from Boston and New York during the summer. And she's right. one of the summer people, but she's one of the summer people who everybody just loves. And it's not because she donates money to charities and events and, you know, things like that. But because she donates her time and her and the time is the most valuable thing that the summer people have. And they are very sort of withholding of that for local purposes. Yeah. And she, you know, for every bake sale, she shows up. For every time they're trying to hold a fundraiser for the library, she shows up. And she's just always there. And she's warm and she's funny and she's vivacious. And she's got this obsession with trying to find shortcuts between any two places. And basically over the course of the story, we watch her kind of reel Homer into this obsession that she has where she will drive from one place to another that should take about 2 hours and is, you know, 110 miles on this odometer. But she's able to get there by taking these like increasingly backwoodsy dirt roads where suddenly it's taking 90 minutes and then it's taking 80 minutes and then it's taking 50 minutes. And it should not be possible that she is getting from this place to this other place in this short period of time. And eventually he goes with her. And as she and when he does it, he sees that she's kind of entering into this strange other world where there's these, you know, creatures that are kind of like what you see in The Mist. But beyond that, it's causing her to age in reverse. She's getting younger and she's getting healthier. And anyways, the whole story is, you know, I kind of think of it as Stephen King's The Bridges of Madison County. It's this memory story about kind of this, you know, long lost love that almost was but never was, and kind of yearning for that. But the depiction of Mrs. Todd is also like really kind of sad and filled with empathy and pathos, and it's just beautiful. Anyways, so that's kind of the story in a nutshell.
The thing that I'd like to first talk about is this whole concept of being obsessed with finding shortcuts, which is you know, I'm not sure how much of the story, you know, resonates today in the era where everybody has a GPS on their phone and they just kind of go where the GPS says. I have a feeling that if King was writing this originally today, then it would be like some magical, you know, Google Maps or whatever showing a different route. But there, you know, as somebody who, you know, I was born in 81, so I'm technically a millennial, but like I'm in that zennial cusp thing where, you know, mm-hmm. a good portion of my life was pre-internet, and I got my driver's license, you know, in the 97, right? And so that was when the internet was around. But you know what I use the internet for to get around? MapQuest. You know, if I was doing a road trip, I would travel and print out the maps ahead of time. And it reminds me so much of that kind of that pre-GPS era of like, yes, okay, I'm going to want to go here and I want to stay on the main highway here, but if I get off here, then I can go visit this town and it'll, you know, it always congests around the city, so I can cut this. Like, it reminds me so much of like of a bygone planning period, which I just don't think most people do anymore. I mean, maybe retirees and trailers or something, you know, mobile trailers that drive around, you know, RVs and whatnot. Maybe they still do something like this, but like, I think for the most part, this is a gone obsession out of society.
Yeah. And I think that's maybe part of what I like about it. There's something, you know, kind of nostalgic and a little sweet about it. It's like, you know, I do find it refreshing whenever I read a book or watch a movie that's, you know, set in the pre-cell phone era where suddenly you don't have to answer the cell phone question. Why don't they just call for help? You know? Mm-hmm. And I find it really charming. But I love the time period. It's funny. I don't know if this is too early to go into a tangent, so stop me if it is, please. But so in terms of the specific, like, going on, you know, down these odd impossible detours, part of what I love so much about it is this taps into, like, my single favorite subgenre in horror, which is the impossible space book. You know, so I feel like this is in lineage with something like House of Leaves, where the house is not behaving the way houses should behave. You know?
Right.
It's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. There's this wonderful author named Brian Evanson who wrote a story called Wind Eye about a house that has more windows on the outside than it does on the inside. Stephen King also wrote about this in Rose Red, where, you know, one day the house has 80 rooms and the next day the house has 90 rooms. And the day after that, it has 110 rooms, you know, and I don't know why. I have always loved this genre. I find it so fascinating and interesting and mysterious. And this is like, this example of it just predates so many others. And so it kind of seems like it feels like he's kind of laying the groundwork for so many other impossible space movies that would come later.
It's also kind of traipsing around in a very common King trope, especially with short stories, which is we're going to go on a ride in the country and visit a place that maybe we shouldn't be visiting and we don't know about it. Like, this is Children of the Corn. This is, you know, they got a hell of a band. You know, this is even for the London version with Crouch End. It's like you somehow end up someplace that you're not supposed to, and that this could be right next to you. And, you know, this is just small town America. If you've ever taken a road trip, you know, and you've gone down the wrong turn, you know, you never know. Maybe you're going to enter into one of these thin places. So, you know, you could argue that Mrs. Todd is driving through a thinny. You could also argue there's an argument to be made that maybe she's, you know, flipping over into another world, kind of the way that Traveling Jack does in The Talisman. It's like King loves to play around with the barrier between realities and what that does and what that means. Even the jaunt is a psychological barrier. You know, that's the one where you go to sleep when you're teleporting to one place to another, but somebody doesn't, and they realize it's a very, very long time mentally in that teleportation process. You know, it's all very interesting, and I love it when King plays around with this stuff. And you get little glimpses of dark towery, misty monsters. Like, one of my favorite things is, like, on one of the trips, like, and Mrs. Todd is done it so much, she's like, yeah, whatever, of course that tree grabbed my hat, you know, like the fucking, you know, Wizard of Oz or something, you know. It's like, oh, don't worry about this. I think it's like a gopher or a woodchuck or something that she hits that also has a head full of poison and has fangs, and it's embedded into the front bumper of the car. You know, it's like all this stuff is like, well, what are you doing in there? And then you add in all that, you know, stuff about how she's aging in reverse. And by the time we see her, she disappears for a long period of time. And when she comes back, you know, Homer, the main storyteller, is an old man in the 70s, and she's a teenager, and she's like, Hey, hot stuff coming. Want to go for a ride with me? And it's implying that he's getting younger as well when he's going on these rides with her. So, you know, I love that he doesn't over-explain it either. It's not like, well, now we have to figure out what this is. It's like, this is just a thing that exists. And that's something, again, that's another thing that King loves to do, where it's just like, I'm not going to explain this to you, but there's a fucking door that goes from our world to fairy tale world. You know, it's like, that's it. You don't need anything else. Shit, sometimes that crazy shit, that little magic does exist just right next door to our own reality, you know, and that's just how it is. And it's a natural thing that we can't understand or explain. Yeah.
But the thing that's interesting is that there's not like a logical or a narrative explanation for why she's aging in reverse. There's like an emotional reason, you know, and the emotional reason is kind of the thing that I love so much about it, you know. Like late in the story, Homer's basically trying to say like, hey, maybe you shouldn't be doing this. Maybe this is a bad idea. Like this seems dangerous and strange. And, and she has this like really wonderful monologue where she's talks about like, you know, when I'm out there, I feel different than I do in my normal life. I feel like I'm bigger and more important and more interesting than the world around sees me. I'm like, not just this woman who tried to write poetry and failed at it, this woman who, you know, takes notes during committee meetings, this woman who could never carry a child to term. And in this moment, you sort of see that she has like all of these, you know, kind of, you know, these quiet inner sadness, these regrets, these, you know, and this is her opportunity to kind of live life to the fullest. She gets to be an adventurer. She gets to, you know, kind of brave the unknown, which, you know, everything else about her life in the context of the book is, you know, very simple and domestic and familiar. Right. And she yearns for something more. And so as she throws herself into the danger, she gets younger and she gets, you know, and in some ways she maybe becomes like more of herself. It's almost like she gets a chance to start over again. And I find that so beautiful and so interesting.
And she gains her freedom and independence because they make a big deal out of how her husband declares her legally dead. And then like after a respectful, you know, mourning period of like a year, then he's got a new, you know, a new Mrs. Todd is going around town.
Yeah.
You know, and then the old one shows up and what's also interesting is that it's called Mrs. Todd Shortcut, but a lot of it's about her not being Mrs. Todd anymore. Right.
Yeah.
And they don't refer to her as Mrs. Todd. They refer to her as Ophelia or even Diana. They're like, you look like Diana, you know, the goddess of beauty, the virginal goddess of beauty or whatever. Mm-hmm. Which is another weird thing. Cause King does this a lot around, especially in short stories around this time too, where there's just these mentions of like casual mentions of like, oh, maybe she's like this goddess in the same way, like the Lawnmower Man, where, you know, that's an agency run by Pan and, you know, all these Greek mythological, you know, characters and whatnot. It's like, I don't know what exactly was in the water, but he was really interested in all that shit, you know, in this time period, especially with the short stories.
Well, it in a weird way, it just felt like him trying to root the supernatural elements in something sort of pre-existing. It's funny because he does like make up a lot of his own mythology from scratch, you know, but there's a lot of other stuff where it's just like, oh yeah, you're trying to root it in something else. Like, you know, even in something like It, you know, where like, that's all pure King. It's weird because he keeps trying to say like, all right, it looks like a clown, but really it's this other, you know, it's this turtle in space, but really it actually goes further back than that. And so he keeps trying to root the thing in something else. I don't know. That was sort of my take on that particular aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's ultimately King always, you know, one of his special powers, one of his talents is that he always roots it into a recognizable world. Have you done many road trips in your time? Were you a road trip person? Because I did a lot of fucking road tripping around the country when I was in my 20s.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a handful of them. I've driven across the country twice. It's. I mean, for me, it was a very humbling experience. What was it like for you?
You realize just how much fucking empty places there, even sticking to the main highways. Like you did, you know, I've done the drive from Austin to Los Angeles, you know, a half dozen times in my life. And going through East Texas. Well, one here, this is interesting because there's one point where maybe I had my own Mr. Vespy shortcut here because I did that trip multiple times throughout my 20s and 30s. And you can always, you know, set your watch by it takes about 12 hours to get from Austin to El Paso, right? Half of the drive, you're still in Texas. That's how fucking big Texas is, right? You know, it's usually between 11 and 12. So if you stop a couple of times, then it'll be closer to 12. If you drive through with one fill up, it'll be closer to 11, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There was one trip that I took with a friend where we hit El Paso in about 8.5 hours, and we weren't speeding. We didn't, we stopped a couple of times. There is somehow we, you know, we did this trip that we've done a billion times and somehow shaved like 2 hours off of the trip. And I have no idea how, and I was never able to replicate it after. We didn't take an alternate route. It wasn't like we were detoured anywhere. It's just for whatever reason, this time we went, it only took us 8.5 hours to get from Austin to El Paso. So, you know, I don't know, maybe those little, shortcuts, maybe those little wormholes do exist somewhere on, you know, on this, you know, on this planet.
I feel like my equivalent of that would be less in a car and more just like, you know, I grew up kind of out in the woods and, you know, I was very much like a running, jumping, climbing trees kind of kid. And so, but there were a couple of times where I'd, you know, my buddies and I would head out into the woods in the afternoon and the sun would set and then we couldn't find our way back home. And, you know, like I remember one time, you know, some friends and I were making a little movie and at first we had, you know, we brought flashlights. So we're just like, oh, we can find our way back. But then the flashlights died and we're just like, oh, shit. And so then we took the little viewing monitor from the camera and we turned it around and faced it to the ground. So that was a flashlight. And then and we were out there for hours and we're just like, well, if we just walk in one direction long enough, eventually we'll hit a road. And you can walk a really long time in the woods in Maine without hitting a road, you know? And so like it felt like wherever we were going, the woods was just extending itself to keep us trapped. And
you had your own The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon experience. Yeah.
yes, exactly. Yeah. And so yeah, I don't know.
Did you eventually find your way out? I mean, obviously you did, but like, was it a search party? Was it like, oh, no, we stumbled out ourselves.
It was, you know, around like midnight or something. We finally got to a house and we knocked on the door. And of course there's like an old man who like came out. I don't think he had a shotgun, but he might as well have. He was, well, you know, it's out in the country. Who's knocking on his door at midnight. You know, we used his phone and we called our parents, but, yeah, it can get spooky out there, but you know, but one of the effects of you know the way he writes about this place is he makes very ordinary things seem mythic, you know.
Yeah.
And I always loved feeling like, oh, I was growing up in some place special, some place that had a mythology to it, some place that you know could contain monsters. You know, and the story very much does that for me.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about those monsters, because that's like the kind of meat and potatoes of the story is, you know, the Stephen King diehards reading it going, all right, they still rubbing their hands together. Here we go. Here's the weird shit. You know, it's kind of like the parts in From a Buick 8 where you get to see the crazy shit come out of the trunk. Mm-hmm. Right. That's still a novel that bounces mostly off of me, but I love that conceit. And, you know, I think that that's a version of that's here in Mrs. Todd's Shortcut where, you know, there's just this, you know, plane where there's these things that are recognizable, but just not right. You know, it's like, it's not like a completely alien tree. It's just a tree. This one happens to have a face and reaches out and, you know, tries to grab hats off of people's heads as they drive by, you know, or the gopher thing or all the other creatures. Like, was this kind of a moment? I know when, you know, I don't have vivid memories of reading this for the first time, but like I do have an instinct of that my, you know, when I read this the first time in, you know, the middle school age or whatever, that I probably perked up around this going, ooh, what are these? These are like wasteland creatures from, you know, from a Dark Tower. It's like, well, you know, what are these now? Let's get into this. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, if I'm being honest, I think the first time I read it, I'm just like, a woodchuck? Really? I mean, it's not a very scary word. It's not a very scary sounding animal. But like, then a few pages later, you kind of realize what he's setting up, where, you know, Homer says like, hey, look, like, if this is what the woodchucks look like in this part of the forest, like where there's woodchucks, there's bears. And if this is what the woodchucks look like, imagine what the fucking bears look like. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the part where I'm just like, oh shit, yes, this gets much worse. universe. And so he's kind of showing you just the tip of the iceberg, and he's kind of suggesting that there's far bigger and darker and scarier things out there, you know, which, you know, like that's something I thought he did really beautifully in like Pet Sematary, where he's always hinting at something larger and scarier being in the forest than whatever it is you're actually seeing. But
do you think he intends that to be more of a barrier to overcome? Because it's not like traditionally that would have been the warning in the setup where, you know, she goes in and she never comes out again or whatever, but that's not the story here. She goes in and then comes back, you know, her complete younger, more accomplished and independent self. So do you think that's just more intentionally there narratively as like, this is a barrier of entry for the fear that keeps people who discover this thing out, that maybe might be rational, but you know, maybe not in reality, you know, does that make any sense?
I think it's that. I think it's like, you know, I mean, what's interesting is that, like, you know, Ophelia's fearless. Homer's the one who's just like, maybe we shouldn't do this. Like, how about we stay inside? Because it's funny. I mean, you're right. He uses monsters in like a variety of ways, depending on what book or story you're reading. And in this, it's like he doesn't really make a meal out of it. By the time we see the little woodchuck thing with the fangs and the poison, like it's basically already dead, you know. Like, and so the monsters aren't really the threat, or at least to me, or I take that back. It is a threat, but it's a threat that we don't actually spend a lot of time with, yeah. You know? And to me, that's always like one of the really interesting, like, kind of telltale signs of any given writer is like, what do they choose to dedicate narrative real estate to?
Yeah.
You know, like he dedicates a lot of time to just characters, like, you know, talking about like what they're going to have for dinner that night and, you know, flirting with each other. He spends not a lot of time, you know, dealing with the horror. Like in a weird way, the more upsetting thing is there's this brief moment, you know, where Ophelia, it kind of seems like she's maybe going crazy. Like she's become obsessed with this thing that she can't let go of and that maybe it's going to kill her. And so in some ways it's almost more of a psychological horror movie than like, oh, the monsters are going to get you, because, you know, Homer can just not get in the car and not go in the woods. Like he has control over that, you know.
Yeah.
Ophelia doesn't. She seems kind of compelled by this, you know, and has lost control of herself. You know, and eventually you realize like, oh no, it's not that she's lost control. Like, no, she actually just wants this. This is making her happy, not in a way that she's unaware of. She's actually keenly aware of it.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. Sorry. Did I sidestep the question?
No, you got it. I'm not crazy. There's a love story at the center of this thing, right? Like Homer's got an infatuation with Ophelia, but you know, I guess because it's mostly from his point of view, I didn't get a really great grasp on her feeling towards him until pretty much the end when she shows up to like, hey, you know, hop on in, tiger, kind of thing. It occurs to me that that's probably the heart. If you ever adapted this thing, that love story has got to be at the center of it, kind of in the way that, you know, that there's like a good love story wrapped up in, say, Frequency, that's a father-son love story, or, you know, a romantic love story in About Time and dealing with, you know, both of those are daddy issue movies. So, but you know what I mean? Where there's like this greater craziness that's going on that's, you know, kind of a hard sci-fi or hard fantasy, you know, angle to this. But it seems to me if you were going to adapt this into a feature film, that, you know, you'd lean pretty heavily into the story between Homer and Ophelia.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, to me, that's the heart and soul of the story. You know, these two people who have found themselves in lives that, you know, their lives kind of happened to them. It almost feels that they didn't really pick this, that, you know, that maybe they're both in marriages of convenience more than passion or love. And, you know, now in their 30s or 40s, they've kind of realized that they've made a mistake along the way. And there's this other person who is right for them and who they are drawn to. And, you know, and you know, neither of them is really willing to act on it. And it's the thing that makes the story so sort of poignant to me. It's very beautiful and it's very sad and it's, you know, but there is this like tension throughout all of it. This, you know, you want them to be together because you can see that they're both very unhappy people. And in some ways, you know, you kind of want to shake Homer because you're just like, you know, be as brave as she's being, you know,
yeah, right.
You kind of want him to man up in a way, but I think it's a great relationship. I mean, it's, you know,
it also just has that good emotional punch where, you know, it's a kind of will they, won't they story. I could see that being the building blocks for this, you know, being adapted. Right. And then, you know, you have that great emotional, you know, conclusion where you think maybe they miss their window and she disappears and he grows old. And then, you know, after being peppered, you know, throughout about how she's looking slightly younger. And then, you know, the late teens, early 20s version of her, you know, pops up, the Margaret Qualley, you know, version of her pops up, mm-hmm. you know, at the end. And, you know, for the old man going, all right, come on, you know, you get it. I don't know. Maybe it's my love of this kind of movie from my childhood, because it's like, you know, I grew up with Cocoon and Batteries Not Included and even Spielberg's Kick the Can segment and in the Twilight Zone movie.
Oh,
it's like,
yeah, I love that one.
You know, which is, you know, it's sentimental and cheesy but and sappy, but, you know, it has a similar thing of like, here's this, you know, old person that's going to get their second chance. And you know that there's a happily ever after there, but it, you know, comes after some bittersweet, you know, loss and regret. I don't know. I think there's a pretty rich material to mine, you know, and I'm surprised that nobody's adapted this. I think it's been a couple of dollar babies, maybe. I think there's been a few dollar babies that were made mm-hmm. based off of Mrs. Todd Shortcut. But, you know, this seems to me like it'd be a shoe-in for, you know, I don't know, at least an Amazing Stories episode or a Twilight Zone, you know, a reboot, you know, episode. It feels like it could fit well within that, if not its own just like great tight 90, you know, minute movie, you know?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I think, you know, oftentimes a lot of his short stories or his novellas, you know, make for, if not better adaptations, at least, you know, you can sort of see it a little more easily, you know? It's just like, how do you compress 600 pages into 2 hours? Like, that's, you know, right. that's a job. I've always wanted to see a movie version of this. I just think it's, like you said, it's so rich and there's like so many wonderful ingredients to it. I think the creatures are cool and scary and, you know, and again, just that relationship at the heart of it all, I find really beautiful.
Right. So if you were making this, you'd expand the romance. If I was tasking you, like, write me a feature length adaptation of this, you would enhance the romance. Obviously, I think you also gotta like have more time spent in that other realm, right?
Yeah. I think that's one of the big things, because the love story is there and the romance is there, and you'd want to spend more time with, you know, Mrs. Todd's husband and Homer's wife, and so you kind of see why they're unhappy as opposed to being told why they're unhappy. But yeah, I think a lot of it is just like, you know, they kind of drive through that strange supernatural woods in the middle of the afternoon. And then he has the opportunity to drive back at night and he doesn't. And it's just like, oh, I want to see those woods at night. I want to see what comes out when the sun goes down, and see someone get stuck in there and maybe they're stuck in there for, you know, a full evening or days or something like that. Maybe time moves differently in this place than it does in the rest of the world, like in those old grim fairy tales. I don't know. Right. There's so much that you could do with that. I think it would be really fun and interesting.
It's also interesting to like kind of address, like, at what point does the de-aging stop, or does it? You know, it's like, you know, so she's like, hey, stranger, get in this. And by the time he's in his 30s, like she's a like a mewling like infant. It's like, wait a minute. Like, you know, maybe, you know, or maybe this place is a little bit more like, you know, your ideal version of yourself, and it's crafting that less than it de-ages you. It's just taking you to your, like, who you picture in your mind, you know, because when you talk to, you know, older folks, or you see, you know, people in nursing homes and they're doing interviews and talking about it, they don't see themselves as old, you know, broken people with arthritis and wheelchairs. They, you know, they go in my mind, I'm still, you know, 24 years old and so maybe that's the reality. Yeah.
And I think that is kind of it, like that, you know, like this is actually one of the things about Stephen King books that I find interesting is like the difference between the ages of the characters in the books and in the movies. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think Jack in The Shining is like 30 years old. Compare that to Jack Nicholson in the movie, who was like what, in his mid 40s or something like that. To be like a 30-year-old parent of a 6-year-old is very, very different than to be a 44-year-old parent of a 6-year-old. You have like way more life experience, way more wisdom, knowledge, you know, all those things. And so, you know, it's
way more
it's
backaches.
Yeah, exactly. And but also just the like, if I don't finish my novel now, it's never going to happen. You know, it's weird because as a 44-year-old, like, I don't know, those maybe feel, you know, I'll preface this by saying I'm 40, that I would feel that much more keenly now than I would when I was there, or I would feel it at 30. But at the same time, you're 30. You don't know anything. You think you know something, but you kind of don't. And so it's, yeah, like, I don't know it in terms of how that applies to this. I don't know. I just find the way age is treated in his stories is always really interesting to me.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. And he also spends a lot of time with older characters, like, and yeah, I mean, he's good at writing all characters, you know, of any age, whatever, but like, I think he particularly shines when they're very old or very young, you know. Mm-hmm. That's when you get your Mother Abigail's, or you get, you know, even talking about Pennywise is an ancient thing, or Randall Flagg's an ancient thing, or, you know, very much anything in the Dark Tower, you know, is older than you'd think. And I don't know. It's like, I don't know what it is about it. Maybe it's just because fiction doesn't center on those age groups as much. It's usually teenagers to 40 somethings, you know, and that's leading most of the novels that I grew up reading, you know. And I guess there's a whole young adult, you know, fad that kind of hit after me. So maybe it's not true for literature anymore, but I don't know. There's something that he held on to from childhood that he was able to recognize, that even when I was a child reading his stuff, I very much felt like he saw me and remembered what it was like being a kid.
Yeah.
And authentically, and you know, I'm old, but I'm not fucking old yet. But I kind of get this feeling that, you know, when I'm reading his, I'm going to reread Insomnia when I'm, you know, in my 70s or 80s, God willing, if I make it that far, you know, and I'm probably going to be like, he fucking understands me. Like, you know, how did he fucking guess what it was like to be an octogenarian? You know, it's like,
It's funny. He said something once in an interview where he said, I'll never understand people who look back at high school as this idyllic time. He's just like, I hated it. I hated every moment of it. And it's just like, yeah, high school was rough. That was a rough period of time. I don't know many people who don't feel that way, but it is weird how often it's depicted as like, these are the best years of your life. And it's just like, Jesus Christ, don't tell me that.
So do you have any other favorite King things before we sign off? Like, is, you know, Mrs. Todd Shortcut is the thing you were drawn to talk about. But like, if I held a gun to your head and said, you know, name me your favorite Stephen King book or short story, like right now, you know, what is the one?
I mean, honestly, it would probably be On Writing. Like, I mean, the first half in particular, the memoir section, I love that so much. It is like, he has a great life story to tell, and he tells it beautifully. You know, and there's something, it's sweet and it's personal. Like the story about like finding out that like he sold Carrie and he's gonna make $400,000 out of the deal, and he wanted to buy his wife something because it was Mother's Day, and I think he bought her, like, you know, a hair dryer, yeah.
You brought her a hair dryer, yeah.
Yeah, just shoved it into her hands, and she's like, "What the fuck is this?" You know, it's beautiful. It is such an awkward, lovely, beautiful story, and I just, oh man, every time I read it, I just find the whole thing so inspiring, and also just like, you really get a sense, you know, of his craftsmanship and his work ethic, you know, because, you know, when I was young growing up, I always thought like, oh, writers are people who get inspired and in this kind of feverish burst, they produce great work. And it's just like, yeah, sometimes it's that, but more likely it's like you have to sit down at your typewriter or computer or whatever, and you work, you clock in at 9, you clock out at 5, and you spend your day working, you know, and, yep. And in some ways it was the book that taught me what it means to be a writer more than any other.
Yeah. The thing that's miraculous about On Writing is that it's both an English teacher telling you how to write, but every time it starts getting a little too school marmy, it segues into the other side of it, which is the memoir. And he bounces back and forth in a way where you're actually getting and retaining some really important information about writing and on the technical side of writing and on the... like you said, the motivation side of it, where it's just like, you know, just got to be consistent with it. So you get all that stuff, but then it's all peppered in with all these great Uncle Stevie stories where, you know, little things like talking about how, you know, he saw a friend got, you know, obliterated by a train when he was young. He didn't remember it, but like he tells the story the way his mother told it to him, of like him going out to play with this kid and then coming back hours later and he's white as a sheet and just fucking went to bed and never talked to anybody about it, and how it was like a trauma that he, you know, it's like maybe it's still buried deep in there, you know, and maybe that's where the body came from, maybe, you know, that's where, you know, a lot of his pet cemetery, you know, trauma of kids dying early or something, you know, came from. Maybe it came from there, or he'll, you know, have a funny story about his babysitter holding him down and farting on his head. You know, it's just like, you know, I love how he's able to, you know, to balance everything in that book. And every time I revisit it, it's that's something that impresses me more and more.
Yeah, no, I love that one.
Well, cool, man. Well, I think that unless you got anything else you want to bring up regarding Mrs. Todd's Shortcut, or I mean, I was going to say or Stephen King, but I think it feel like you're like, okay, how many hours do you have to talk about the rest of his stuff? So we'll just cut it off here. But this is the point in the show where you know, we'll give you a little bit of room to publicize what you got coming out. So if you want to make one more, you know, pitch for the flick, this is a good time to do it.
Woman of the Hour. It's gonna be on Netflix on October 18th. So yeah, check it out there. Thank you. Great. Thank you again for having me on. I really.
Oh, thanks so much for. Oh yeah, sorry, I just talked over you, but thanks so much for joining me and for bringing this title up for discussion. It's a very interesting one. Many thanks to Ian McDonald for joining us. I always like it when we get these kind of hyper specific main feed episodes here where we focus on a short story like Mrs. Todd's Shortcut. So I appreciate Ian for picking that as a topic and letting us kind of dive into the meat and potatoes of that short story. Next week, we have another short story on offer in the main feed. Well, I guess it's more of a novella. We are venturing back into the mist. And joining us in the mist is a video game developer. He was somebody who worked at Bethesda for many years. You know how much of a Fallout and Elder Scrolls fan I am. So when the opportunity came to talk to Mr. Nate Perkypile about his latest video game, one that he broke off from Bethesda to go do and shepherd and bring into the world, and it looks rad as hell. It's called The Axis Unseen. We're going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about his work at Bethesda, building, you know, Diamond City in Fallout 4, or building Blackreach in Skyrim. We're going to talk a little bit about all that stuff. We're going to talk a little bit about his new game and, of course, The Mist. So that is up next week for your ear holes. And then this Friday, we have an exclusive bonus episode over at the Patreon. That's patreon.com/thekingcast. Sign up, throw us a few bucks, and you get a bonus episode every week. So just like you get one in the main feed. So like we like to say around here, if you're only listening to the main feed, you're only getting half the show. It is the best and most direct way to keep the show afloat. And I think I should also mention now, we hit 4 million downloads between last episode and this one. So thank you all so much for the continued listenership, for the continued support. I know that Scott was very proud of hitting these milestones and And I am going to feel his pride for this occasion. So thank you all. So sign up at our patreon.com/thekingcast and hit us up with a couple of bucks a month, and we'll make it worth your while. Not only do you get the brand new bonus episodes coming out, you get instant access to all the stuff we've done over the last 4 years. So that's quite a hefty amount of material to go over. All right. Well, I think that's all the housekeeping. So I will see y'all in the main feed next week to talk about The Mist. Adios, folks. The Kingcast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abby Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.